Calendar this morning is John Snow v. State of Nevada. That's 53884.
No deal.
Counsel, if you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Anthony. I represent the petitioner, John Oliver Snow. I would like to reserve 4 minutes, if I could, for rebuttal. In Mr. Snow's petition below, he alleged that the state failed to disclose material, exculpatory, and impeachment information, that the state presented and failed to correct false testimony, and that the state violated his right to counsel by sending in a government agent to elicit incriminating statements from him. In the penalty hearing, the state presented the testimony of a jailhouse informant. His name was Richard Morelli. Mr. Morelli testified about incriminating statements that Mr. Snow purportedly made to him and testified that Mr. Snow solicited him to murder a state witness. In the petition below, we've presented evidence that was obtained for the first time during the federal proceedings that Mr. Morelli was a career informant for the Metro Intelligence Division of the Metropolitan Police Department. There's been no dispute below or in the briefing that that was something that was not disclosed to defense counsel. Also not disclosed to defense counsel was an executory promise of benefits that related to a probation revocation on an underlying grand larceny conviction. If you look at the timeline of the events before trial, in December of 1983, Richard Morelli was arrested for two counts of sexual assault with a deadly weapon. If you look at the timeline, in January of 10th of 1984, Metro Intelligence Officer G.G. Miller went into the jail to meet with Morelli. On January 12th, there was a change of plea. And at the change of plea, the prosecutor, Dan Seaton, represented that Mr. Morelli was going to be pleading guilty to the sexual assault offenses. And he also talked about the grand larceny revocation. And what he said, and I quote, is that, quote, if certain things are to occur, we would have a favorable disposition for Mr. Morelli. If these things do not occur, we'll go forward with the revocation proceeding. It's our contention that what Mr. Seaton is referring to is he's referring to sending Mr. Morelli back into the jail to elicit incriminating information from Mr. Snow, and in exchange for the statement, they would not revoke his probation on the underlying grand larceny revocation. Fast forward throughout the month, Mr. Miller makes several trips into the jail to talk with Morelli. February 13th of 1984, Mr. Morelli is sentenced on his sexual assault cases. February 15th, he gives a statement to Metro where Mr. Snow purportedly makes incriminating statements to him. The very next day, February 16th, his probation revocation proceeding, the defense stipulates to the grounds for revocation, but he doesn't get revoked. If he would have been revoked, Mr. Morelli would have served an additional 5 years in prison before he started serving his sentence on the sexual assault cases. On direct examination, the prosecutor elicited the sequence of events regarding the sexual assault, and then he asked Mr. Morelli whether he'd received any other promises or benefits in exchange for his testimony, and he said that he had not. It's our contention that Mr. Morelli's testimony or the impeachment information would have been material to the penalty verdict because no other witnesses testified about this alleged solicitation offense. There was also allegations in the petition below that the state failed to disclose material information that relates to the identification of Mr. Snow by the co-conspirator at trial. Her name was Kathy Faltinowski, and also by the two purported neutral witnesses, Arlen and Jody Edwards, the next-door neighbors of Mr. Wham. They testified about hearing gunshots from the garage of Mr. Wham's home and seeing an African-American gentleman running out of the garage and identifying, at least from the testimony of Jody Edwards, identifying that person as Mr. Snow. What the state didn't disclose that we've alleged in this petition is interview notes that were taken of Jody and Arlen Edwards before trial, where they talk about how before they gave information to the police that Kathy Faltinowski, the co-conspirator, informed them that she saw a black man running behind the townhome directly after the murder offense. We've alleged that that's important to the guilt phase issue here because, first of all, we have cross-racial identifications, which can be inherently unreliable. And secondly, and more importantly, with respect to Kathy Faltinowski, the state alleged that she aided and abetted a conspiracy to murder Harry Wham by falsely saying that she saw a black man running behind the townhome after the offense. In Mr. Snow's trial, they presented that very same testimony as if it were the truth. And they used that testimony to make Ms. Faltinowski's positive ID of Mr. Snow, when at the same time they had charged her with aiding and abetting the conspiracy by falsely stating that she had seen a black man running behind the townhome. It's our contention, again, that if you look at the testimony of the neighbors, from the testimony of Arlen Edwards, he testified that he couldn't identify Mr. Snow on the stand. If you look at the testimony of Jody Edwards, she originally said that she couldn't identify the man. She testified at the Peggy Wham trial that she couldn't identify him. And then at Mr. Snow's trial, she testified that she could identify him. In addition to not disclosing the information that Kathy Faltinowski, the co-conspirator, had spoken with the Edwardses, we've also alleged that the state failed to disclose letters that were written by Kathy Faltinowski to Ms. Edwards. When Ms. Edwards was asked why she changed her testimony, she said that she was threatened by Kathy Faltinowski and by Peggy Wham. But if you look at all the letters that the state had in their possession, those letters show not that Kathy is threatening Jody Edwards. She's talking about her children. She's talking about innocuous things. And she's trying to ingratiate herself with Ms. Edwards. So we would assert that in addition to the prosecutor's interview notes, there was also a failure to disclose these other materials that deal with these letters that were exchanged between Kathy Faltinowski and the Edwardses. And we would allege that that's material to the guilt phase because the issue of identification was a material issue in this case. Very briefly, I want to talk about the sequence of events because I think one of the questions that would come is why is it that we're raising these issues at such a late date? At the time of trial, it was the prosecutor represented that they had an open file policy. Under this court's precedence, when you say that you're representing that you have an open file policy, defense attorneys have a right to rely upon that fact as being true. And an open file policy means that all the relevant material in the file should be contained in the open file that counsel gets to review. None of the information that's in this petition was in that open file. Now, as a matter of state and federal law, when the state says they have an open file policy, defense attorneys get to rely upon that fact. Defense attorneys don't have to automatically assume that prosecutors are being less than forthcoming. And that, in one way, explains why there was this delay and why this information wasn't fleshed out earlier. But in this case, we have much more than that. In this case, we have a federal court order from 1995 requiring the state to disclose the information in their open file and to disclose material in the possession of Metro. None of the information that's in this petition was disclosed by the state in 1995 pursuant to that order. again in 1998. We have another discovery order, this time from the state court. In that order, the state requires the disclosure of all evidence in the possession of Metro that relates to these state witnesses. Once again, none of the information that's in this petition was disclosed in the 1998 discovery order. So then we fast forward to our office being appointed to this case. We send out informal records requests. Those are routinely denied by the state because they require a court order. We received authorization from the federal court to serve subpoenas. We're not allowed to serve subpoenas unless we can show good cause and receive a court order. That law is the same in state and federal court. As soon as we served those subpoenas, we didn't get any response to them by the state. We got a motion to compel granted against the state. Then, after that, the state started asserting privilege objections. They said that this stuff was work product. If the court reviews the state's brief, they're still arguing that it's work product and that we shouldn't have it. So that issue had to get litigated. Eventually, we had to file motions under seal to compel. And it wasn't until June 4th of 2007 that the federal court finally said, you need to turn over the prosecutor notes that talk about these conversations with the prosecutors and with the Edwardses to the defense so they can use that in their petition. And also Kathy Faltanowski's pre-sentence report. Until we received that order, we didn't have all the material that we needed to bring a petition here. Once we got all that information, we wrote up a petition, and we had a petition on file in this court within 1 year of the state purging themselves of a contempt order in federal court. It's our contention that when the issue comes up about why it took so long, the fundamental flaw with the district court's decision below is she didn't consider the state's litigation conduct. She didn't consider their open file representations, and she didn't consider their litigation conduct in federal court. It's our position that that provides a reason for us coming at a late date in presenting this Brady claim to the court, and we would submit that the district court erred by holding that claim was barred. Very briefly, and then I'll sit down and reserve my time, I wanted to talk about a claim of actual innocence. We've alleged that the burglary aggravating circumstance that was found in Mr. Snow's trial was invalid because it was predicated on an intent to commit murder when entering a building. That aggravator is construed in that circumstance is the same as the decision in the McConnell case, which is aggravating circumstances need to narrow the class of offenders who are eligible for the death penalty. Here, if you take what would be a second-degree murder, you could bootstrap it into a capital offense by saying that it happened inside of a building. It's our contention that you can't take a second-degree murder that happens in a building and say that that sufficiently narrows the class of offenders in order to sustain a death sentence. And so on that fact, we would argue that the burglary aggravating circumstance is invalid, and under the Bennett case, the court needs to consider the prejudice from the invalid aggravator along with the failure to disclose evidence about Mr. Morelli, the informant. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office on behalf of the state of Nevada. This is an appeal from the denial of a fourth state habeas petition. It's a rather lengthy history. Documents are not easy to find in this lengthy appendix that we have attached to this file, but I've done my best, even though the state bears no burden, simply because they make an allegation, they wave some document around saying we never had this. It's not my burden to go back into the record and disprove that, but that is exactly what we did in this case. In regards to Richard Morelli, their first claim of a Brady violation, I don't know whether that was disclosed earlier in the case. I was not able to find references in the trial record about his status as an informant. What we do know is by the federal public defender's own allegations, they discovered that information in October of 2003 and waited 5 years to return to state court to raise it as a state claim. They found the document, this memo or letter from Detective G.G. Miller stating that Richard Morelli had assisted him and cooperated on a number of cases. They found that document in Richard Morelli's case file by simply walking over across the street into the 8th Judicial District Court, going up to the clerk and saying, could I see Richard Morelli's file? And in there is where they found this. didn't require a subpoena, didn't require a discovery order, didn't require any litigation. All it required was a defense attorney saying, hey, let's go look at Richard Morelli's file. They found that in 2003, and they waited 5 years. That is why that claim is procedurally barred. Yes, there was litigation in federal court. There was protracted discovery and motions to compel and all sorts of business that went on for 5 years, and I was involved in some of that. But the documents that they rely on for the Morelli claim did not arise from any litigation in federal court. It arose, they found it by walking over and looking at a case file that they always had access to. The one exception might be the jail visitation log. They didn't get that from me. I didn't have that. They got that by sending a subpoena over to the Clark County Detention Center and requesting the visitation log for Richard Morelli. There's a document in the record. I've never had a clean enough copy that I can see what it says. I think it says G.G. Miller's name on there as perhaps visiting Richard Morelli. I've never been able to view the dates. We proceeded on the Federal Public Defender's representations that they can read the document and that it shows that G.G. Miller was visiting Richard Morelli in January of 84. Well, they knew from October of 2003 that G.G. Miller was visiting the defendant, or Richard Morelli, and providing information. The jail visitation log didn't give them anything additional that they didn't already know from G.G. Miller's letter. And if you want to go by the date, they have the jail visitation log. That's January 12th, 2007. They still waited a year and 3 months after that document before returning to state court to raise this claim. So whether or not the claim has merit, whether or not Richard Morelli's status as an informant should have been disclosed, and this is an informant on some other cases. G.G. Miller had no connection to the John Snow case that we're aware of. What the state of the law was in 1984, I think the defense has or the federal public defender has a burden here to prove that that's what the state of the law required under Brady, is that even if Richard Morelli did not receive any inducement for his testimony in the John Snow case, the fact that he had provided information on other cases to this detective, that was Brady material. Certainly is Brady under today's law. It's not at all clear it was considered Brady material in 1984. There's no other questions on Richard Morelli. Well, I would note that during the protracted litigation in federal court for those 5 years that they sat on their claims before returning to state court, they took a deposition of Dan Seaton, who did this negotiation and dealt out Richard Morelli and pled him out to a couple sexual assaults, and for some reason held off on a probation revocation for an attempt grand larceny. Dan Seaton, the prosecutor, was able to look at that transcript in 2007. I wasn't part of that deposition process. The Attorney General was representing the state's interests at that time. But Dan Seaton looked at that transcript where he said that certain things are going to happen. We're going to hold off on the revocation for a month. He read that and said that that he didn't have any recollection of this case, but in his mind it did not indicate necessarily that there was some sort of deal. And he also rebuts what Mr. Anthony said about the state's open file policy. Dan Seaton clearly said in 1984 he expected and did receive from defense attorneys all the time these Brady motions. The U.S. Supreme Court case law says that not all open files are the same, open file policies. And we have had in the DA's office an open file policy that has changed over time, and at different times and places it means different things to different people. It means one thing in federal court where they don't experience it. Means something quite different to the attorneys that actually practice in the 8th Judicial District Court. In 1984, our open file policy did not relieve defense counsel of a burden of going and looking at the case file of Richard Morelli, going and doing their own investigation. It's only when the state lulls the defense into inaction by saying, you don't have to go look anywhere, we've got everything you need right here. Only then does the state somehow commit a Brady violation by failing to disclose some of these documents. There's no indication that in 1984, the attorney in this trial, Joe Houston, was lulled into inaction and did not investigate the case because he was under the assumption that we had done all his investigation for him in the open file policy.
And Joe was a former former DA and public defender, and what we used to do in 1984, since I practiced in the area, was not only have the open file from the district attorney's office, but go look at Metro's file. And that was what everybody was supposed to do.
I want to move on to Kathy Faltonowski. There's a number of documents here that they're relying on for this claim. Faltinowski's PSI, the pre-sentence investigation report, is a prime piece of evidence that demonstrates the problems that I have and the inaccuracies that the federal public defender, their incorrect allegations. Judge Kadish, in this case, faced with all these facts, all these allegations, asked for supplemental briefing and said, I want very short supplemental briefs, no more than 5 pages. I want to know, federal public defender, when did you receive this document? When did you receive this document? How did you receive it? Spell that out for me. In regards to Kathy Faltinowski's pre-sentence investigation report, that supplemental petition from the federal PD was very enlightening. It showed that they had received this document no less than 6 times, only the last of which was from me in the federal discovery litigation. According to the federal public defender, they received a copy of that PSI in 2006 from the public defender. They received it again in later December 2006 directly from the Department of Parole and Probation. They received it in 2007 from the Nevada Department of Corrections. And then finally, they received it from me in January of 07, claiming they couldn't use it until June of 07 because of some protective order in place. I had only withheld the PSI because it's not my document. There's confidentiality that pertains to it. And I said, you can have it. There's one attorney note that is totally irrelevant to this case. There's one attorney note scribbled on the front of it. I claimed attorney-client privilege as to that one note, but I said, you're entitled to the PSI. Just give me an order protecting me from liability for disseminating further this confidential document. They could have had that for me years ago if they wanted to get it from me, and they got it from many of these other sources going back clear to 2006. And yet we know, even despite all that, receiving that document 6 times and then pursuing on a motion to compel me to get that same document a 6th time, we know from Mark Picker, prior counsel for John Snow, that he saw that Kathy Faltinowski's pre-sentence investigation report by going over and reviewing in the court clerk's office Kathy Faltinowski's file, and he did that in 1998. There's a declaration from him in the exhibits in the appendix saying he saw it. It was there. He couldn't get a copy of it right then, but he saw it and could read it and look at it, and it felt it was important. He could have asked for an order from the court to actually obtain a hard copy of that. And interestingly, on this PSI, I went back and I'm looking at the trial record, and I see that attorney Joe Houston in 1984 sought to admit the pre-sentence investigation report of Kathy Faltinowski. That is found in volume 7, page 1626. Joe Houston had this document all along. But because we're here on a fourth petition, it's been 25 years, we're wasting important time and resources going back and looking at these cases, combing through the record, trying to find when did they have this document, when could they have raised this claim. We find that they had this document at least 6 times, and probably trial counsel had it the entire time. The Faltinowski letters that they're referring to, that was the subject of the third post-conviction petition. That was procedurally barred. That was upheld on appeal. That is nothing that was disclosed here lately. That was in 1998. That has been litigated already. The letters from, or the attorney notes, Jody and Arlen Edwards, they're basing some claim on the attorney notes. I actually copied them. They're right here. What is marked in black, they got to come over and look at my file and look at every single attorney note and unredacted copies. And then the federal court let me go back, redact out those things that were irrelevant to their claim. And so here's the attorney notes that support their claim regarding the Edwards. It's 3 pages, and there's maybe 1, 2, 3 lines, one on each page that is pertinent to their claim. Those statements say nothing more than what was already in the police reports, no more than what was already testified to in the trial, no more than what appears in all the other documents they have. There's nothing on here to indicate that these were interview notes taken during an interview with Jody and or Arlen Edwards. I don't know what they were. I wasn't around in 1984, but they very easily could have been some attorney looking at the police report and writing down what was in the police report. There's nothing in those attorney notes, if you go back and look at them, nothing in there that wasn't already in the file. They're trying to bootstrap that and say, well, we had to fight you to get this. And that's why it took so long to come back to federal or come back to state court. We did fight over this. We fought over everything that's in black that is totally irrelevant to this case that was properly excluded and kept out. On the actual innocence claim, this was raised as claim 14 in their fourth state habeas petition. It was a two-page argument. It contained no case authority. Today they represented it as a McConnell claim. It always sounded a bit like a McConnell claim to me, but curiously they never cited the McConnell. I never knew it was a McConnell claim that they were making. No case authority in their petition. It was summarily disposed of on that ground alone. But we went ahead and we responded to it, and we argued that it did not meet the standard for actual innocence because they weren't raising any new claim of here's some new evidence showing he's actually innocent of an aggravating circumstance. No, it was a claim that he was that the burglary aggravator was legally insufficient to make him eligible for the death penalty. A claim of legal insufficiency is not a claim of factual innocence. We also pointed out that this claim had been heard before. It had been filed at least twice before. The first time was in the first post-conviction petition in 1986. These things are not easy to find. They don't volunteer this and they say, hey, we're re-raising this claim. They leave it on me to pour through 5,000 pages of documents, comb through all the prior issues in the case, and they cite no case authority, and then I have to go do the response saying, hey, they raised this before. The Nevada Supreme Court, in looking at that claim, this is long before McConnell, they said Snow was convicted under a theory of premeditated and deliberate murder. In those circumstances, not every premeditated murder is committed inside of a building. So in this case, in these circumstances, the burglary aggravator does provide the requisite constitutional narrowing, and it was validly applied to him, and it was upheld. So it's been law of the case since 1986. They raised it again in the third post-conviction petition. It was addressed in the findings of fact. They, in their reply brief here on appeal, claimed that the judge didn't address it and that I didn't address it. There is an entire paragraph in the judge's findings that pointed out that this claim had been raised and decided before and was law of the case. This is a case that is about 25 years old. They keep coming back on petitions to exhaust state remedies. It's a bit of a game. They should not be allowed to litigate and pursue discovery on unexhausted claims that they raise in federal court. For whatever reason, the federal courts are allowing that, and they'll sit up there and they'll take depositions and they'll send out subpoenas and they'll do it for 5-6 years. That is an election they make when they do that. They could and they can and they do file concurrent state habeas petitions at the same time that they have their federal litigation going on. Since we've been pressing the Culley claim, they have been getting back rather quickly from federal court, knowing that we're going to procedurally default them, and so they can get back quite quickly from federal court. Well, they like to take advantage of the liberal discovery rules up there. We have discovery rules in NRS Chapter 34. If they file a state petition and raise the claim that they're already aware of and are litigating in federal court, they file it in state claim, give us a chance to respond, and then they can assert and use discovery rules under NRS 34. They choose the forum, not us. They make an election of remedies of where they go. They may need to file a federal petition to preserve that, but there's nothing that prevents them, under state law, prevents them from filing a successive petition at any time. Their delay in federal court and their pursuit of federal remedies does not constitute good cause, and the petition was properly denied. I encourage this court to affirm Judge Kadish's ruling in this case. Thank you.
I think that one of the things that's important to point out here is we have a situation where Brady evidence is uncovered for the first time in federal habeas proceedings that have occurred obviously many, many years after conviction. The issue becomes, what do we do when we get it? Do we use what Mr. Owens refers to as the favorable federal court procedures? Or do we put all of our eggs in one basket and come back to state court? Or do we rest with what we know, which is that if we present that to the federal court, we at least get one opportunity for discovery?
Can you do concurrent petitions like Mr. Owens said?
That is certainly an interesting suggestion. That has never worked before. What usually happens is if concurrent petitions are filed, usually the federal court stays the federal proceeding and defers to allow the state to hear it in the first instance. The problem that we have here, which Mr. Owens keeps coming to, is this is a fourth state petition. Below, the state said, and this is something I agree with, is that the state said below that I wasn't entitled to any discovery in state court, and he's right about that. I have never come back to state court on a successor petition and gotten any discovery. And so what I'm left with is I have my shot in federal court, I have a motion to compel, I have contempt orders. The question is, do I litigate them and force the state to hand over the things that they're not turning over, or do I risk some other procedure? Unfortunately, what we're dealing with here is the law is really unclear on this point.
Counsel, isn't Mr. Owens absolutely correct, though, that you make the choice of where you're going to go and for what purpose? If you want that discovery that you get by being in the federal court, that's your choice. If they stay it because you have to protect your rights in the state court, it's your choice, knowing all the time that there's a pretty important clock ticking.
It's a hard way to characterize this as a choice. The one thing under the law of Brady, the law is that you have to look at everything together. And what would happen if I put aside the motions to compel in federal court and I put all my eggs into the state court basket, I have to, again, get the state court discovery granted. And what I risk is I risk piecemeal litigation. And so what happens is, either way, the state could use that as a sword. They could say that one of the arguments they made is that you can't look at some of the Brady information that occurred that was uncovered in 1998. So what happens is if I don't succeed in getting that discovery, and then I got it later from federal court, and I came back later, they would say, you can't look at all the Brady allegations together. And so there's a real push and a pull here. If you look at the closest state law authority, there's the Siragusa case that I cited that says you have to have all the pertinent facts. And I think that if you look at the range of options I had, I think it was reasonable what was chosen to be done here, which is to force them to disgorge all information that they had before filing this petition. Thank you. Unless there are any other questions.
Court thanks counsel for their spirited arguments today and providing information to the court as to this underlying issue. With that, we will submit this case. Our next argument is